This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Not too long ago, we had on the show a guest. He was a doctor who called death an, quote, idiosyncratic part of human life. We don't know where, when, or how it's going to happen.
Which is probably why most of us don't like thinking about it at all. But when asked, 70% of Americans say that when the time comes, they want to die at home, surrounded by friends and family.
Truth is, the exact opposite happens here in Massachusetts. More than 70% of deaths in the state happen in hospitals or nursing homes, with people often spending their last days or weeks attached to high-tech, life-supporting machines.
That's according to a commission appointed by Governor Deval Patrick to study the end-of-life care in Massachusetts. Last week, the commission released its recommendations.
In today's Radio Boston Talker, we're going to take a look at a particular type of end-of-life care, hospice care, and a new proposal to extend hospice benefits to more Massachusetts residents. And we'll start with Massachusetts Senator Patricia Gelin. She was a member of the governor's expert panel on end-of-life care. Senator Gelin, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So I understand that you are planning to file legislation that would expand hospice benefits to certain Massachusetts residents. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, hospice is included in all other insurance products in Massachusetts by mandate, and it's certainly included in Medicare. But people who have MassHealth Basic and MassHealth, Essential, that's very confusing to me, there's many different kinds of MassHealth, but those two groups of people who are mostly long-term unemployed people who haven't been able to get certified as disabled, those people don't have a Medicare MassHealth benefit for hospice.
And they don't receive any sort of federal benefit through...
They have no coverage for hospice. They do have... Those two groups of people do have coverage for hospitalization. So if they're being discharged from a hospital, they may have to stay in the hospital longer at much greater expense and less comfort for themselves than if they could have benefits under their plan. They can transition to MassHealth standard. That was the reason that wasn't included. But in talking to other folks, it seems that it takes a while to make that transition. There's a lot of bureaucracy and paperwork, and that may be the amount of time that one has left on the earth.
I don't want to sound unfeeling about this, but the people who you're speaking to, when the time comes and they do pass away without extending hospice benefits to them, they are passing away in hospitals or nursing homes. Is that correct? So they are receiving some form of care.
Yes.
Okay. So why then open up or try to subsidize some form of hospice care to them? It's not as if they're out on the street.
Right, but I think that the point of the expert panel was try to make sure that everybody in Massachusetts has a choice about the kind of care they get. It's not more expensive care, but you want people to have a choice, and not everybody will make the same choice. Some people will choose to stay in an ICU hoping for miracles for every moment, and other people will choose to – more people – according to surveys, will choose to be in a more comfort-centered environment.
Mm-hmm. And how many people in the Bay State would fall under this new benefit if
you're able to get
it passed?
Groups of people would be about 120,000 people, which is about 0.1% of the MassHealth population, and even less percent of the Massachusetts population.
So,
it's not a very big group of people.
Okay, so it's a narrow target that you've got here in a huge sea of people, basically everyone in the entire state who has to one day think about end-of-life care. So I want to also similarly expand the conversation a little bit and invite two more people into our discussion. We're joined now by Dr. Lachlan Farrow. He is the head of palliative care at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, and he was co-chair of the governor's expert panel on end-of-life care in Massachusetts. Dr. Farrow, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Also with us in the studio is Pam Sozier. She is a nurse and vice president of Merrimack Valley Hospice, and also she is on the board of directors for the Massachusetts Federation of Hospices. Pam Sozier, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
So, Pam, if we can, let's start with you. As we heard Senator Gelin say, people want to have greater options when it comes to end-of-life care. And I guess you could say that it's something of a no-brainer to say, hey, hospice is one of your options. But I understand that not people, when they've reached that stage or their families have reached that stage, they often don't even think of it or know that hospice is an option. Have you found that to be true?
Absolutely. Frequently, people do not know about hospice. I would say the number one comment that we hear from our families is that we wished we had known about you sooner. So even those people that we do get on hospice are often referred very late, and the benefit is for 6 months, and oftentimes these people are only able to take advantage of it for a couple of weeks, some people only a matter of days, because they are referred so late.
When you say the benefit, what benefit are you referring to?
The MassHealth benefit also mirrors the Medicare benefit, hospice benefit, established by Congress in the 1980s.
So you're eligible for some form of coverage for 6
Correct.
Months.
Correct. Uh-huh. So if you have a life-limiting illness that if everything goes as usual, your death is going to occur in less than 6 months, you are eligible for hospice.
And what if you're on private insurance and not on MassHealth or Medicare?
Most private insurances also have a hospice benefit. Now, if you get to 6 months and you're still, you still have the same clinical criteria that are required, we can continue to take care of you. I also will say that there's been several recent studies that show that hospice care actually extends life. And so sometimes we have patients graduate from hospice. They actually get better, and they go off of hospice and then usually come back on at some later date.
We are talking about end-of-life care in Massachusetts and a new report out from a panel of experts that Governor Patrick convened to find better ways of taking care of Massachusetts residents when they do reach the end of their lives. Listeners, what is your experience with hospice care? Have you or a loved one wanted it but couldn't get it or didn't even know about it? Or maybe for some reason couldn't afford it? And when we think about the larger picture when it comes to end-of-life care, how early actually do you want to know about all your options, whether it's the hospital, the hospice, or home? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dr. Faro, you were co-chair of the governor's panel here.
Yes.
When it comes to hospice, when we can't talk about healthcare of any kind without talking about costs, but I've read that in some forms it's found that hospice care actually reduce costs when it comes to overall end-of-life care.
And so our expert commission actually wanted people not to think first about cost. That's not the point. The point is quality, and the point is taking care of people the way they would want. Now, it turns out that frequently a patient with a life-threatening illness in the emergency room is offered, come in the hospital, do everything possible to prolong your life. They may not want it. And that same patient, if in fact hospice were offered, would have care that they really wanted. Oh, and by the way, it might cost a whole lot less. But if you start talking about the point being cost, you're talking about something different from what the healthcare system is supposed to do first, which is take care of people the way they want.
So we heard Pam say that one of the reasons why people aren't getting the care that they want is because, A, they may not have known their options until very, very late. But, what are the other barriers then right now standing between people and getting, hospice care if that's what they wanted or any kind of care that they want at the end of their lives?
I'd say the biggest barrier that I think all of your listeners are familiar with is we don't want to think about this. And people say it's too early until it's too late. We don't want to think about it. So then what happens when any of us, and it'll happen to all of us, has a life-threatening event, we rush to the hospital, absolutely the normal thing. then in the hospital, everybody's panicked. And when in doubt, gee, try to save a life, try to save a life. And so it's got momentum of its own. And then that's exacerbated by a healthcare system and hospitals that tend not to have on staff all the time people who know that there's another choice. Mm-hmm. There are other choices. It doesn't need to be in the hospital. And so we fail to inform people once they get to the hospital of the choices. The families are panicked. They're, you know, we got to try to save life. And the tragedy is it's all predictable. And if we can help each other talk about these things, share experiences about hospice for my mother, the intensive care, the life-prolonging things for others, if we can talk about it together, which is not easy, but we're all in it together, so let's all talk.
I know that cost was not the focus of the recommendations that the commission came out with, but I don't want to leave that issue entirely just yet, because earlier today when we were discussing this here at Radio Boston, one of our producers said that, you know, a very close friend of his mother had recently passed away, and that she did end up, she died at home the way she wanted to, with care as well, but that the only reason why it was possible is because they were able to pay for it. I mean, it was actually kind of surprisingly expensive to have the type of care needed at the end of life at home. And I'm wondering, is that a barrier that some people are fearful of, that they don't think they would get coverage for that?
Well, actually, it's a huge barrier because it's not just that they don't think so. My mother, alive in Connecticut, loving her life, if she's rushed to the hospital, which one day she may be, she's in her 80s, then in the hospital, if she says, or if I'm there and I say, well, I don't know what to do, like, you know, keep her alive, thousands of dollars a day, hundreds of thousands of dollars of care is available to her there. And if she were to say, or say, I know she wants to be at home, the Medicare hospice benefit pays, what, $100-something per day at home? There's very little money in the home choice. And so if she wanted to be at home and have, you know, a home health aide every day or nurse every day, we'd have to get together with kids and find the money.
Really? Pam Sosier, is hospice in general underfunded then? Is that part of the problem?
Well, if you think about it, we, you know, get money, we're paid on a per diem basis. And so not only does the nursing and the social work and the chaplains and the aides, all the visits have come out of that coverage, but hospice also covers all of the medications that pertain to the hospice diagnosis, to the terminal diagnosis. And if you've bought Dilaudid recently, you know that it's very, very expensive. Hospice also covers all of any the durable medical equipment, whether it's a hospital bed or anything the patient needs in the home. So there's a lot of expenses that go into taking care of a patient.
We've got a lot of listeners who want to share their stories with us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Josh is calling from Quincy. Welcome to Radio Boston, Josh.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me on your show. I wanted to add a personal experience that I had with hospice care. My father died of cancer several years ago, and we actually had an experience with hospice care at the last, ended up being the only maybe 2 to 3 days of his life. But in that experience, one of the things I want to share with you is when we consider the needs and wants of the actual person who is dying, whether they want to experience their end of last hours in an institution or in a home setting, we can't overlook what that experience has on the family who is surrounding them. You know, your quote earlier on about folks wanting to be around those, their family and friends. I'll tell you, as a late teenager that went through this, as my father spent his last few days sort of dying in bed at home, it was an incredibly traumatic and difficult experience for the family as well, to figure out how to take care of them, what we would do in between when the nurse was visiting, when we were given all of the different scenarios of the way he could potentially go. It was really traumatic for the children and certainly for my mother, his wife. So, you know, it tends to be a different debate depending on who's talking and whose perspective it is when you think about this experience of end-of-life care in the home setting versus an institution.
Josh, stay with us for just a second. Don't go away. I want to actually turn your thoughts to Dr. Faro and get a response from you. Dr. Faro, I mean, families who live with the aftermath of this, what do you have?
Yeah, and I really want to thank Josh for this perspective, because I've been doing this a long time. actually the single most important thing for most patients is that whatever last phase is like, that it's really okay for their families. That's what they care actually most about. And if the hospice option at home is going to be traumatic for their family, then home may not be a good choice. Now, maybe there's more support at home that could actually make it a wonderful experience and memories of being at home. But we have in Massachusetts a small number of what are called hospice residences where a parent can be there near home. The rooms are just like home, and then the family, when they come there, a teenage son should not be worrying about taking care of dad as a nurse. The son should be there as a son.
Josh, did anyone talk with you or your family members while you're going through this process about what help you could get?
It's interesting you say that. We didn't really consider hospice care because I don't think it was presented to us until the very last days. And I think, again, what's difficult about this scenario is I remember very clearly my father absolutely wanted to be home and absolutely wanted to be sort of surrounded by his things and his family and his children. And it's difficult. It's almost like the ultimate pink elephant in the room when you're trying to have and go back and forth with a family member who is dying to basically try to understand and respect and want to honor their need while at the same time trying to figure out how that's going to work for those who are eventually going to survive him. So it made up for a very sort of difficult conversation and many times things that we didn't even really want to say in front of our father and explore as readily in terms of options.
So. Josh, thank you so much for sharing your story. Let's hear what Pam Sosier has to say.
Josh, I mean, certainly that's the experience you went through as a teenager is one of the, probably one of the experiences you're going to remember the rest of your life and losing your father. And that is what hospice care is about, is to support not only the patient and make sure the patient is comfortable, but also support the family, because the dying process doesn't just happen to a person. It happens to the entire family unit. And even after your loved one is gone, part of hospice's responsibility is also to follow the family for at least a year after the patient dies. So I don't know if that happened in your case, but that's also part of hospice's responsibility to provide support.
Let's get another call in here. Patricia's calling from Chelmsford. Welcome to Radio Boston, Patricia.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What's your thought today?
Okay, so, my husband, he's young when he was diagnosed with cancer and had progressed very rapidly. So it was kind of sudden and very difficult for us to make the kind of decisions on what would happen to him. First of all, we elected to go forward with hospice out of rehab, and the rehab facilities are probably the first place where people should really be introduced to the idea because, either people are going to be getting better or they're not. And I think we dragged on in rehab a little bit too long, and those decisions weren't really presented to us. I finally had to kind of make a stand and say, he's not better here. I need to take him home. So once it was brought together, hospice was absolutely wonderful. We were on private insurance. We'd always, taken care of ourselves medically. But when we were given the decision to take him home for hospice, he needed very, severe care, 24-hour care. He had seizures and a lot of problems. So we either had to put him in an in-hospice facility that insurance would pay for, or if we brought him to home hospice, his nursing care would have to be subsidized by me. And we elected to do that. I was fortunate enough to, he had a small IRA. I basically tapped the entire thing out to pay for that, leaving very little for his two small children. But in a general sense, that kind of decision that the private insurance is allowed to make, I just can't see that that's really fair, that I wasn't given any subsidies as far as that 24-hour nursing care that he would have gotten in an in-hospice, facility.
Patricia,
that would have been covered.
Patricia, do you mind if I ask, you said you had to tap into his IRA. I mean, how much did it cost at the end of the day?
He was sick for 3 months, and it was out-of-pocket $35,000.
Wow.
It was everything he had saved for 40 years.
Patricia, thank you so much for sharing your story. Dr. Farr, I see you want to respond to that.
Yeah, when people talk about money as the elephant of the room, which it is, the money is already a problem today that If a patient has two choices, as Patricia, your husband, did, or more than two choices, and one of them these days it tends to be hospital kinds of things, is paid for so you don't have to bankrupt your IRA and leave the two kids without money, and another one's not paid for in the same way, cost is already pressuring people into things that are different from what they want. We need a healthcare system where the doctor and the family and others say, what does this patient really want? And cost is a neutral factor in that.
So, Senator Pat Gelin, in that case, what's the next direct step that you think? I mean, you're a member of this commission that the state of Massachusetts can and should be taking then to get us closer to helping people get what they want at end of life care, and in some way where they're not fearful of things like cost.
Well, I have to say that I don't like to talk about things that I don't know as much about as the other people on the panel, but it's news to me, some of the questions about what you have to pay for. So I think the first thing that we will do is there'll be I hope that the Elder Affairs Committee and the Healthcare Finance Committee will be having some sort of briefing on the report. And then I think we need to look at the question of what the benefit covers, if it's possible to cover things that would make the choice between a nursing home and keeping someone home be neutral. But I do think besides cost, there are other barriers. And I think the barrier of conversation and communication is the biggest barrier, even beyond cost, that people don't talk about things until it's too late. I'm certainly one of those people.
And Pam Sozier, are there practical things being done on the ground right now to help overcome those barriers?
Oh, absolutely. I've been in hospice for 21 years, and it's been a battle for all those 21 years. And so we continue to try to educate every day, whether it's giving presentations, whether it's talking with families, whether it's having family meetings, whether it's educating physicians, whether it's educating other healthcare professionals about hospice care and what the benefits are.
And Dr. Faro, your response to that, and also just one last question from you. This isn't the first time there's been sort of a blue ribbon panel to take on this very difficult but truly important issue. So what makes it different, you know, in your mind this time around, that we might actually make some progress towards improving end-of-life care?
Right. So connecting those two questions, previous commissions all over the country have helped spark more and more hospitals and other facilities to have staff that are trained in these things, but actually – you don't have to as a hospital. You know, you can't imagine a hospital or medical practice where somebody with advanced cancer does not have an oncologist, a cancer doctor, to talk to them. And yet it's perfectly fine to not have a palliative care hospice a person there to talk to you. Why do we even allow facilities to be licensed if they don't have professionals that can provide the choices? Right? A second, and to our panel, to our commission, absolutely crucial thing is our healthcare system is getting better and better at measuring quality, like blood pressure control and other things like that. We need to start measuring, it's not going to be hard, measuring the quality of information that patients and their families are given and whether they have their choices expressed, and if the choices are expressed, was the care the way the patient would want it.
Well, that's Dr. Lachlan Faro, head of palliative care at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and co-chair of Governor Patrick's expert panel on end-of-life care. Dr. Faro, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Senator Pat Gelin, member of the panel as well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
And Pam Sozier, vice president of Merrimack Valley Hospital Hospice and board member of the board of the Massachusetts Federation of Hospices. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
There's more after a break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.